So the first presentation that I have is a joint effort by myself, Lewis Klein, and Mark Salzer. We're all at the University of Temple University in Philadelphia, and we're all part of the Temple University Collaborative on Community Inclusion of Individuals with Psychiatric Disabilities. And what I'm going to be talking about is the use of spatiotemporal data mining to study community mobility of people with psychiatric disabilities. So no disclosures for me. And I guess I'm going to start by talking a little bit about the background of this study. So first of all, community participation and community mobility basically is important as has been found by the World Health Organization and the International Classification of Functioning. It's important, an important determinant of health outcomes. And as of now, pretty much all of the studies that have looked at mobility and participation have been using subjective retrospective measures of those constructs. However, with the advent of GPS technology, there's been some use of GPS to measure mobility in particular. And the studies that we've found that use GPS have tried to measure community participation, community mobility, and physical activity. However, in our literature review, we found that most of those studies have some limitations. In particular, they only look at a handful of possible measures that are related to these constructs of participation, mobility, and physical activity. They don't really provide a detailed description of how they deal with missing data, which is generally a pretty big issue with GPS data collection. And they don't talk about how they create the constructs that are here, community participation, mobility, and physical activity. Right. So the aims of this study are as follows. First of all, we want to use GPS technology to track individuals with psychiatric disabilities and to create from the data that we collect some measures of community participation, geographic scope of mobility, and temporal scope of mobility. Here, for the way that we talk about community participation, we're talking about the total number of destinations that these people have, the total number of unique destinations, total number of non-home destinations. Then for geographic scope of mobility, we're talking about activity space area and total distance that they travel. And for temporal scope of mobility, we're talking about how much time they spend outside of home, or specifically at non-home destinations. And the second aim is to see what kind of variability we'll see both within individual and across individuals. So how much people will vary in terms of what they do from day to day, and then how much there'll be variability from one person to another. So for the current study, we've recruited 5 participants who have a psychiatric disability. We've recruited them from a community mental health center in Philadelphia. Just outside of Philadelphia. And they all had a diagnosis of schizophrenia spectrum or affective spectrum disorder, 295 or 296 DSM diagnosis. None of them had any problems or any concerns about being tracked. We gave each individual a GPS-enabled cell phone, and we asked them to carry around those cell phones for 2 weeks. On these cell phones, we installed a tracking software, which we used a software company called AccuTracking, which is available for about $10 a month. And the way that AccuTracking works is that it collects data at 1-minute intervals, and it sends those data to an online database in real time. It's a secure, password-protected online database. And again, basically, we're able to get those data in real time if we had to. So the way that the AccuTracking works, again, is that it's installed on cell phones, and you have, for each minute, you have the timestamp, you have the latitude and the longitude, and then you can export the data into a GIS like ArcGIS or Google Maps, or into Excel. And the good thing about people who have concerns about privacy is that the data are purged from AccuTracking's website after 30 days. And it's fairly cheap. It costs only about $10 a month. Now, of course, there are some limitations of collecting data with GPS. The first thing is that when you're indoors, the data collection is either not going on or the quality of the data collection is very poor, unless the phone is put next to a window or a glass door. So basically, in order for GPS data collection to happen, the phone needs to have sky access. Of course, also GPS is draining on the phone's battery. We also might have issues with participants forgetting to take the phones when they go outside the house. And we're also a little bit concerned about them changing their behavior when they have the phone. So for instance, they might not go to places that they usually go to, or go to places where they don't normally go to, or giving the phone to somebody else. But these are, I guess, fairly small concerns, and we believe that there's still a lot of merit to the method that we're using. So one of the biggest limitations, however, is missing data. So if we didn't have any problems with getting with tracking individuals when they're at home, then we would expect to have approximately 20,160 observations, because if we have one observation per minute, there's 60 minutes an hour and 24 hours in a day, and we're tracking them for 14 days. When we multiply that all together, we have 20,160 observations over the two-week course of the study. But of course, because individuals won't have been outside all of that time, we do expect that there will be some missing data. And that leads to some problems, which I'll talk about a little bit later, when it comes to creating some of the constructs. Another issue is identifying destinations from GPS data. So imagine that we're all at this location over here, and we don't move, and the cell phone is at this location. Just because we're here, there'll still be a little bit of error when the GPS sends the signal to the data set. To AccuTracking. So even if we're not moving, AccuTracking might record our location at these non-start points, which will ideally be fairly close to the star location, but there might be a little bit of variability. So when it comes to identifying clusters or destinations, we need to be very careful, and we need to take this into consideration. So how would we go ahead about identifying those destinations from GPS data? We use a spatiotemporal data mining tool called STDBScan, which stands for Spatiotemporal Density-Based Spatial Clustering of Applications with Noise. It was developed in 2007 by two Turkish scientists, Berant and Kut. And there is an application which was developed by Alex Fechner, who is basically a data mining expert living in Germany, and he made his package available for free. It works very well with this free open source data mining package called RapidMiner, so you could do these sorts of analyses without paying anything. And what STDBScan asks you to do is it asks you to put in three parameters. The first parameter is called min points, which is the minimum number of points that you need to form a cluster or a destination. I'll use the terms cluster and destination interchangeably throughout this presentation. So in our study, we said that in order for there to be a cluster, we need to have at least 10 points. Then the second parameter is epsilon 1, which is spatial distance for points to be within a cluster. We set this to 200 meters. And the third parameter is epsilon 2, which is non-spatial or temporal distance. And we set that to 20 minutes. So in other words, we're considering 10 points which are within 200 meters of each other and which are sequentially within 20 minutes of each other to be within a cluster. So these are our clusters or destinations as using STDBScan. Now, there are some issues with missing data as well. What happens if we had two consecutive points which are within 200 meters of each other, but which are more than 20 minutes apart? In other words, this is caused by missing data oftentimes. So a person comes to a destination, goes inside, spends 20 hours inside, and then leaves, and the next available point is 20 hours later. What do we do? Well, we can still consider the point after which the individual leaves the location as part of the initial cluster. So we come up with this heuristic approach of how to deal with missing data, and we have three rules here. So if one point is part of an STDBScan destination cluster, and the other one, the next consecutive point, is a transit point, then the transit point that follows the STDBScan cluster becomes part of that cluster, assuming that it's within 200 meters and within 24 hours. If both points are transit points, so if we have a transit point and then after that transit point we have about 24 hours or less than 24 hours of missing time, and then we have another transit point, kind of like what we see here, then we also group those two points within the same cluster. And then if we have two points within two separate STDB scan clusters, and again, those two points are within 200 meters and between 20 minutes and 24 hours apart, then we put those two clusters as part of the same STDB scan cluster. So this is our way of dealing with missing data. So from that, we go ahead and we create a bunch of other variables, a bunch of other variables related to destinations. So the first one is the number of non-home destinations, and basically we go ahead and identify all home we identify the home location from the participants' information that he provided to us at the beginning of the study. We geocode the home location, and then we say that destination clusters which have centroids that are within 200 meters of the home address would be considered to be home clusters. And we can also calculate the number of non-home clusters. So every cluster that's not a home cluster is going to be a non-home cluster. And we also can calculate the number of unique destinations. And I'm going to skip the details of how this variable is calculated, but imagine that the person returns home 15 times over the course of the study period. We have those 15 clusters, but they're all the same. They all correspond to the home location. So we group them together as a single unique destination. Then we also go ahead and create some measures of geographic scope of mobility. So the first measure that we create is activity space area. So these are all of our points. We have some cluster points over here, and then these yellow stars, they represent the unique clusters, or we call them mega clusters. But all of those points are within this polygon, and this polygon we call activity space. This is basically the minimum convex polygon that contains all of the transit and destination points for an individual. And we do this for the entire scope of the study, and we do this for each participant for every day as well. We also calculate the distance traveled for each participant. So basically we look at the distance in kilometers between all temporally consecutive points and add them up. And then because there will be some distances within a cluster, kind of like what we see here, if the points are within a cluster, we subtract that from the total distance traveled in order to minimize the error. Right. And then we also have the temporal scope of mobility. And there we simply just go ahead and calculate the amount of time that the individual spends at the non-home locations, at the non-home clusters. And to do that, we simply take the last point at each non-home cluster and subtract from it the time of the first point. And we calculate the amount of time that the person spends at each non-home destination, and we add them up. So here are some results. Again, we have five participants, and here we can look at within individual variability. So we can see that for these individuals, for each individual, there's quite a bit of variability from day to day. So this is variability over the 14-day period of the study. So for the first participant, he traveled between he had between 1 and 7 destinations on each of the days, and that was similar for all the other participants. So except for the second participant, his number of destinations per day ranged between 1 and 11. The number of unique destinations ranged between 1 and 5 for some of the participants, and then 1 and 7 for participant 3. There's also quite a bit of variability in activity space. And here we notice that there's a substantial outlier for this first individual. The largest daily activity space was about 5,000 square kilometers. And this is because this individual on one of the days went to Washington, D.C. to visit his family member. Whereas you can see that for other participants, there's much less variability. It goes between 0 square kilometers per day to about 30 square kilometers a day. And distance traveled, also quite a bit of variability. Again, for this first participant, we see that the person on one of the days traveled about 357 kilometers, whereas the others, their maximum was much less than that. And we can also look at some of the activity spaces visually. So imagine here that each polygon is a daily activity space. So for instance, this first polygon at the very bottom is the activity space for the first day. The second one is the activity space for the second day. This is for the third day, fourth day, etc. These blue points correspond to the home location, so the individual always came back home. And then we see that the gray points are other destinations. So this is an example of other destinations. And the red points are in-transit points as identified by STDB scan. Right, so we can see that there's quite a bit of a range when it comes to activity space area for this particular individual. And then we can also look at across-individual variability. And there's definitely some variability from one person to another. For the number of destinations, whether non-home or unique, we see that there's some variability. The standard deviation is definitely fairly high. We see that for the total number of destinations, it goes between 18 and 55. For the total of non-home destinations, it goes between 5 and 23. And for the total number of unique destinations, it goes between 5 and 12. And we can also see that there's quite a bit of variability between individuals on all of those other measures as well. So what are some of the conclusions? Well, first of all, it's possible to use GPS to track individuals with psychiatric disabilities. Secondly, we are able to create a large number of measures that I've shown you just now. So it's possible to do so with GIS tools, with data mining tools, and data management tools. And third of all, we found quite a bit of variability both within and across individuals when it comes to all of those constructs. We're currently working on a 3-year grant from NIDLR, which is the National Institute on Disability, Independent Living, and Rehabilitation Research, to do a study that's very similar to this one, but on a much larger scale. So we'll be collecting data from 120 individuals with psychiatric disabilities. And in addition to creating all of those constructs, we'll be seeing how all of them are associated with various psychosocial outcomes and also environmental variables, such as poverty in the community, crime in the community, availability of resources, and so on. And that's all I have for this presentation, and I'm gonna, I guess, go on to the next one.